having a general understanding of from an ethical standpoint of making sure the information is protected there, right? We all have that under the model rule 1.6. You got to protect the information entrusted to you. So I know I've kind of meandered away from your question a little bit, but to me, that's the significance today of at least where I play a role. It's helping lawyers at least have a good, solid understanding, I guess more from an ethical, you know, practice standpoint, as opposed to today, you know, I'm not as involved as I once was in sort of the more the policy standpoints of how the laws apply to digital music or digital ownership or e-commerce or trademark, et cetera. Although that still fascinates me every day.
Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, as always, your host. Today, I have one of my favorite guys in the whole world as my guest, Brett Burney. I first met Brett at the MiloFest conference, like so many others who have preceded him on this show. And he subsequently spoke at the Maryland State Bar Association conference a couple of years or so ago, and I stalked him there, and I've been a fanboy ever since. Brett founded something called the Burney Consultants, where he provides independent and expert consulting services to corporate executives and legal professionals in the e-discovery area, primarily focusing on the challenges and of e-discovery and providing objective recommendations for litigation support tools and workflows. In addition to that, he's an author and a speaker on legal technology topics. He's been featured at a number of different conferences and serves as the chair of the 2015 American Bar Association Tech Show. He regularly speaks, as I said, all around the nation and focuses a lot on using tools such as your iPad, your iPhone, your Mac, all Apple products. But he's also well-versed in the corresponding offerings on the Windows and the Android side of things. So it's not just all Apple all the time here. But anyway, so Brett's going to chat with us a little bit, and I will warn you, this is a guy that I could probably talk to all day long. And we do go a bit long in our interview, so it's a little longer than normal. But I think there's a lot of stuff here that is pertinent, not just to attorneys, but anybody who's starting a business who uses mobile devices as part of that process. So let's get on with it, and let's talk to Brett Burney. Brett Burney, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Oh, wow. Neil, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. I'm thrilled to talk with you.
Well, I'm not so sure about an honor, but I'm excited to have you. Brett, as I've told our audience earlier, you spend a lot of time traveling around the country, speaking at various bar associations and gatherings of folks on a variety of topics, in addition to your real work. So explain to our audience here just who Brett Burney is and how you came to be.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. I appreciate it. Well, I went to law school, always wanted to do something that dealt with the technology and the law. That's the whole reason I really went to law school in the first place. I was doing a lot of technology work, even, you know, in undergrad and working up. And I knew that back in, well, long time ago, when I first started law school, this was back in 96 that I decided I wanted to go to a law school, and ended up my first year was 97. But I knew then that the internet obviously was going to be fundamentally changing so much of what we did. And I guess I could have gone to medical school, or I could have gone to accounting, right? Because it changed those professions as well. But I chose to go the law route knowing, because I was always interested in, you know, at that time, just at the beginning of MP3 files, and you know, we had cyber squatting and trademark issues that were just being turned on their head with the advent of technology. And I knew that's the space that I wanted to be in. So I was able to do a lot of that. The DMCA came out while I was in school, and I actually went to school in Dayton, Ohio, where Lexis is based. So that was great. Some extra classes there, and really did a lot of work in the law and technology. And so fast forward, I found a niche in my day job is working with lawyers on electronic discovery, which is great because obviously there is a huge technology part there, but there's been a growing body of substantive law around e-discovery and litigation support. And that's my day job. But just quickly, as you said, I found another wonderful little niche in working with lawyers that want to integrate Macs into their practice, which is where you and I have met up before, Neil, at the Macs and Law Office conference. And then that has now transitioned since 2007, of course, with the iPhone, and then in 2010 with the iPad, that I go around to a lot of local and state bar association little conferences where I talk about to lawyers how to use the iOS devices in their practice. A lot of firms bring me in for training, that kind of a thing, and that's the fun part. I'd love doing that aspect of it as well.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Now, you said you came from a technical background, or you knew when you went into law school that you wanted to focus on technology. What was the reason for that?
Oh, I think I was just, you know, I guess a child sort of, well, I don't want to give too much away, but a child of the 70s, growing up in the 80s. And for example, my first computer I remember was the Radio Shack TRS-80, sure, as we finally called it, the Trash 80. Yep. Exactly. You were there. So just the fact that I experimented. I mean, I remember how great it was when I was able to use 16 colors and I had like, you know, three or four sounds that could come out of the little tiny, you know, tinny speaker. I mean, just experimenting with that. And it was a whole new world growing up. And then, you know, transitioning into the Apple IIc was my first Apple computer. And then just working with computers since then. I just knew it's become part of who I am on the nerdy side. As I said, it was just, it was sort of the choice for me was going into the law and just sort of understanding how e-commerce was going to, you know, change the way fundamentally that all of us work. And obviously it's changed everything we've done in society, but I wanted to focus on the legal aspect of it.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting too, because it's not like you became a lawyer who then exploited or leveraged the use of technology, although that's true, but rather, when you became a lawyer, you wanted to focus on how our life changes because of technology and what are the legal ramifications of those changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I graduated in 2000. So, you know, that was a big year, of course. You know, it's the end of the millennium and, hey, you know, new beginnings and everything.
We thought all the computers were going to shut down.
I know. And fortunately, nothing died. You know, no, we didn't have the apocalypse happening or anything. But, you know, I mean, we may still at some point. But, hey, at least it didn't happen in 2000. But I remember the first firm I went to, Neil, I mean, this was, you know, it was in 2000, so granted, it was the start of it. And of course, I'm not on Silicon Valley. I'm here in the Midwest. And, you know, the closest that we had sort of for sort of an e-commerce practice was like intellectual property, you know. So I was working on like trademark issues. And hey, if somebody came through the door that had a trademark issue that had something to do with the web or the internet, the other lawyers at this firm were like, hey, okay, that, you know, that nerdy kid sitting over there in the corner, let's give it to him. But, you know, there wasn't that much going on then. And obviously, I think we still see some of that in the legal profession, because I just know how many lawyers will tell me every single day that I'm not that computer savvy, or I'm not really, you know, tech literate. And that's changing, right? I don't know how you can be a competent practicing lawyer today, unless you have some level of comfort with the technology that you use and touch every day. You know, even the model rules of professional conduct were changed a few years ago by the ABA to specifically make that a duty within our first rule, 1.1 of competence. You know, we've always think of that as sort of a substantive component there, but now there's a technical component. And I always stop immediately here at this point and say, Of course, this does not mean every lawyer has to go back to their local community college and get, you know, a degree in network administration. We're not looking for people to become experts and IT experts overnight. Of course not. But you need to have a general level of competence. In my world, on the e-discovery side, that means at least having a general understanding of how your client handles email. Because if they're involved in a litigation, they're going to have to collect email and they're going to have to produce it to the other side. And so as a practitioner, you need to have a general understanding of do they have an email server or is it hosted in a cloud somewhere, et cetera. And I mean, today that even goes to these devices that we carry every day,
sure,
an iPhone or an iPad or a laptop. Having a general understanding of from an ethical standpoint of making sure the information is protected there, right? We all have that under the model rule 1.6. You got to protect the information entrusted to you. So I know I've kind of meandered away from your question a little bit, but to me, that's the significance today of at least where I play a role is helping lawyers at least have a good, solid understanding, I guess more from an ethical, you know, practice standpoint, as opposed to today, you know, I'm not as involved as I once was in sort of the more the policy standpoints of how the laws apply to digital music or digital ownership or e-commerce or trademark, et cetera. Although that still fascinates me every day.
Yeah. Well, you're not meandering. You're actually forging a straight line into exactly where I wanted to go with this conversation because—
Oh, good.
Yeah. Certainly, e-discovery, it's kind of a hot topic, and I think it's because, my own humble opinion, it's that intersection between technology and the law that that the greater number of attorneys can relate to.
Yeah.
So every conference you go to or every association you look at, they're addressing that issue. And I think that's great. But I also want to talk about, as you suggested, the ethical responsibilities that we as attorneys have with respect to using this technology. So let's just step back for just a second. What's some of the major hurdles in the e-discovery world that we have to be either aware of or get over?
Oh, wow. So that could be a loaded question, I'll just point out maybe a couple of things and probably go back to just the comment that I made a couple of minutes ago, Neil, and just having a general understanding of your client's information systems. And maybe I'll even take one sort of a simple step back. You know, again, not that you need to go in and work with your client and work with their IT people and talk with them about how they store everything and how they, you know, back up everything. Although those questions are important. I mean, you know today that any client that is I don't care if it's a business of one person or two people or 5,000 people, obviously their reliance on technology in the business world is way far more advanced than we have realized here in the legal profession, you know, just as a general rule. For example, cloud computing. You know that just about any business, I don't care if it's one solo person or if it's a 5,000 employee company, if they're in business today, they are using technology and probably to some extent using cloud services. As lawyers, we have an extra ethical concern about using cloud. We all should be asking those questions. But businesses by far have become very comfortable with that because they're selecting the convenience of it, obviously,
right,
and the advantages of using cloud over the concerns a lot of times that as legal practitioners we have from protection or the confidentiality, et cetera, as well we should. But just having a general knowledge, because when I go in for e-discovery, you know, a lot of times then I start talking to the lawyers because I'm usually not talking to the client immediately or, you know, from the very beginning.
Right.
But I'm asking questions like, okay, well, we know once I understand some of the facts, well, email is going to be a very important component of what we need to collect from the data. Then maybe we talk about file shares. Where are they storing files? We might talk about text messages. We may talk about the different kinds of files. If it's a construction litigation, for example, there are different drawings and files there that are important as opposed to, you know, in a family law issue or a domestic issue, there are text messages off of mobile phones. I mean, just having some general ideas, because in the past, 15, 20 years ago, we didn't really have to worry about a lot of these components. We had maybe had one location where the CEO or CFO of a company would have kept their paper files in a filing cabinet in the corner. And maybe that was it. Today, we know that people just work so much differently. And so those are some of the first considerations that I talk about. Yeah. And unfortunately, the lawyers, Neil, when I ask questions and they kind of look at me and like, I haven't talked to my client about where they store their email or what kind of files. And I fully realize that it's not the first thing you may be talking about. But as you get into this litigation, it is going to be something you have to discuss. Well, you have to have a comfort level with that component.
Yeah, and I'm going to suggest that there's virtually, particularly for solos, who our audience primarily consists of, there's almost no area of law that you can practice as a solo that is not going to involve technology.
Yeah.
In this day and age.
Yeah.
And so, that's why I was surprised. I went to a meeting of solo practitioners not too long ago, and the speaker there said, okay, well, how many people here have a case management database?
Yeah.
And it was just a couple of hands. Okay, how many people have a electronic database of their clients?
Yeah.
Same small number of hands. I don't understand how you can practice. I mean, I know that there's practices can still exist on a yellow legal pad, right, and a bunch of papers and a paper journal and a ledger. I get that, but if you're going to be, as you say, doing family law or any kind of commercial litigation,
right,
or civil cases, you're going to have to collect the information that others are using.
That's
right. Such as you said, email and text messages. I tell folks in the family law arena, if you're not reviewing your client's and the opposition's Facebook page,
right,
and if you don't know how to get that information and ultimately introduce it into court if necessary,
right,
you aren't doing your job. You aren't meeting that ethical rule of competence.
Absolutely. Hear, hear.
Yeah. Just I'll jump off the soapbox now.
Well, I like that. And obviously I know you a little bit, Neil. And so I know that you have a higher comfort level than some of the colleagues that you know, or most of the listeners may know. But the way that when I go and talk on technology ethics or mobile ethics at different conferences, I mean, I use this comment. I have a slide that says, listen, if I had a nickel for every time a lawyer looked at me and said, I'm not that computer savvy, or I don't understand, I'm not tech literate. My response is, that ignorance is no longer an excuse. Now, I know where you're coming from. I can smell what you're cooking there, because I know that we don't go to law school to learn about the technology. Nobody sits there and tells you how to run a case management unless maybe you're in a clinic or something like that during law school. But it's like, we're not exposed to that. So I understand where they're coming from. But I don't know how you're going to get away with it for much longer. I mean, the next logical step from your comment, Neil, is potential malpractice. I mean, if you don't know that you have to go and look even from a Facebook, or if you're not even Googling, just a simple Google search for either your client first or even for, their opponent or even doing a search for the opposing counsel, something like that. I don't know how you can feel like that you've even, been competent enough to kind of look about your case a little bit. Anyway, right. Now I'm right on the soapbox there, okay, but I like your comments.
Too. Well, then let's kind of shift the course of this boat here and steer it towards specifically the use of mobile devices.
Okay. Now,
you and I just went to the eye doctor today, and a large component of my eye exam consisted of my relationship with my phone. So all my eye doctor solutions have to fit in with the fact that my phone is surgically attached to my hand. And so I use that technology in my practice all the time. My iPhone, my iPad, and I suppose you could use the competitor's products as well.
Sure.
But we don't talk about them. So tell me a little bit about, what are your thoughts on in terms of the ethical uses of mobile applications?
Okay, sure. Well, just thinking about what we've been talking about now just for a couple of minutes here, I don't know how you can be, again, an effective legal practitioner today if you are not taking advantage of some of the mobile devices that are available to you today. And again, going back to, I understand some people just don't have a comfort level with it. You know, not everybody has it surgically attached to their hand. And I understand that. You know, I meet a lot of lawyers that have been practicing for a long time, and they're not comfortable with the idea of you know, having a device or even frankly, quote, being available all the time, right? We don't want to give clients the idea that we're available all the time. But the reality is, Neil, is most clients do expect that today, right? I mean, it's not like we can change their minds. All of your clients have a mobile device. I can't imagine a client today that's not going to walk in and pay you money for legal representation that probably doesn't use some kind of a mobile device either in their business or at home. And I frankly think, I'm sure most listeners already have a mobile device, so we're already there. But it's like, I don't know how you can't practice. I mean, we're never going to go back the other way, right? All we're going to do is get further into this mobile. It's the Internet of Things. We're going to have the watches. We're going to have implants. Wherever this goes, it's not like we're going to go backwards to just, you know, to doing away with any mobile devices. I mean, frankly, a lot of probably listeners and you and I, we can probably do about 90% of our work from a Starbucks, right? I mean,
absolutely.
As long as we have a laptop and today an iPad or the iPad Pro and even your phone to some extent, nobody really knows where you're doing your work from. And to me, that is such a powerful angle, I think, for so many solos and small firms today, that you can do so much more today with the technology that you have, frankly, even on your wrist, than we could even do maybe 5 or 10 years ago now. You know, sitting chained to a desk with a desktop computer, a big hulking, you know, monolith hidden under the desk somewhere. I mean, we can do so much what we have now with you know, and if we call it an iPhone, which I still find so ironic because it's not, you know, to me, this is a mini computer we carry in our hand that, oh, by the way, there is a phone app on there.
Right.
But I mean, I use it. We could probably fill, you know, 5 pages, single space of all the things that this iPhone replaces today, from a radio, from a newspaper, from a phone, from a note-taking component. I mean, there's so much that it can do for us today that, to me, it still just is mind-boggling from even 5 or 10 years ago.
I'll tell you, in my previous life, I worked in the space program, and we put a man on the moon with less power than I carry in my pocket these days.
How crazy is that?
With all that added capability and those resources and tools available to us now, ethically, what do we have to be careful of? I mean, I think the thing that I'm most concerned about is that client information, what would happen if somebody got a hold of my phone?
Right. Yeah, now, absolutely.
So I'm password protected. I'm fingerprint, you know, compliant. I link to an encrypted database, all of those things. Am I going down the right road?
Absolutely. That's it. You know, and so here, if we're now going to be talking on ethics specifically in the mobile arena, you know, one of my mantras has always been the standard of care, if you want to say it that way, right? The standard is reasonableness. It's not perfection. So let me just throw that out right now, because a lot of times when I talk to a group of lawyers and we start talking about the passwords and we start talking about the security components here, you know, it's almost like if they know that there could be a potential possible, maybe something could happen to where the information could be compromised, then they just put their hand up, right? Oh, no, I couldn't do that. There's no way. But the standard is not perfection. The standard is a reasonable approach. Because right now with your paper, I always say that. Let's go back to the paper. If you're carrying a briefcase around, you've got papers, confidential information, don't you have to take, quote, precautions to make sure that briefcase, those papers don't fall into the hands of somebody else? I don't care if, you know, you're washing it, you have it with you, you handcuff it to your wrist, whatever may be the case. So here's the next step I go to a lot of times. Let's talk about email real quick. People in our world, in the legal world, we send emails all the time. We send emails all day long because, frankly, our clients expect us to communicate via email. And I always say this, email right now as it stands is completely unencrypted. In fact, in 1999, the ABA had an ethics opinion that said unencrypted email is perfectly fine for client communication. And do we not all send the most confidential and sensitive information attached to email messages or embedded in the body of it.
Absolutely.
And I always start there because if you're afraid maybe of the cloud we might talk about in a moment, or we're afraid of, you know, carrying documents on your mobile device, I always say if you send confidential information via email, those are unencrypted messages. So if it bounces off of a server and, you know, over the internet, and you have no control over where those messages go, you hope it arrives in your recipient's inbox, and for the most part it does. But at any one of those points, if somebody were able to grab a message, they could read it without any protection on there. All right, so moving on. I always throw that out.
Those same folks who worry so much, for instance, about data in the cloud are the ones who leave their laptop on the table when they go to the bathroom at Starbucks.
Exactly. And I don't get that. I mean,
or they're not backing their data up. They have a single point of failure.
Right. Exactly, Neil. Exactly. And here's another kind of a slide that I always talk about a little bit, which just kind of helps us put it into reference a little bit. When we talk anything about the security and as we get into specifically the mobile devices here, there's always that balance between secure and convenient, right? It's like, why don't people put a password on their laptop, or why do they just leave it open? Because it's convenient when they come back from the bathroom or come back from getting a coffee, they sit down and they can start working again. If they had to put a password in there, oh my goodness, that's another, you know, 5 seconds that they have to spend to do the password. And is it convenient? Maybe not as convenient, but it is more secure. And we find those same balance there, or that same head-to-head battle all the time between security and convenience when it comes to mobile devices. I am to the point now where if you have, as a legal practitioner, and you have a mobile phone, a smartphone, a dumb phone, doesn't really matter, but mostly this applies to the mobile phone, I guess I would say. And if you do not have a simple PIN number or passcode or a password on there, I don't know how you can practice ethically today. In fact, one of my friends, when we give presentations together, he even goes so far as to say, he talks to a lot of law firms, and the law firms always say, well, it's hard for us to convince our lawyers to put a passcode on their phone. And my friend says, well, then they don't get a phone, or they don't get access to their firm's email. Because if you don't ever carry anything on your mobile phone, if you don't carry documents, or I don't have anything confidential for my clients on my phone, I'd say, do you get your email on your phone? And of course they say yes. Then to me, right there, you have to have a passcode. And we can talk about passcodes. You know, even, you know, the 4-digit PIN number has been around for a long time, at least on the iPhone. You know, the Android, you could tap, or you could actually have a pattern that you could swipe around. But I, you know, even Apple recognized that 4 digits wasn't even quite enough, not quite as secure. So they even switched over to a 6-digit passcode, which was, you know, 1 million times harder to crack, for example, which is great. I mean, Apple is recognizing that as well. And if that's not even enough, you can always put in a password. You can go into the security settings in the iPhone and the iPad, and you can say, I want to put in a 26, you know, alphanumeric password. Is that convenient? No. Is it secure? You betcha. Absolutely. Much more secure than having just the simple numbers on there.
So in terms of the ethical uses of mobile devices, we've talked about, you know, a couple of takeaways here. One, there's a balance between perfect versus secure, absolutely secure versus good enough.
Yeah, right.
And then the second point would be a balance in terms of the level of security that you're applying.
Right.
Is that a fair characterization of the first 2 points?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, because I know from a practical standpoint, a lot of lawyers that I've talked about, that they don't even like to put a passcode in, or they don't like to do a backup because, you know, it's not as convenient. It's like you got to wait for the backup to finish, or they don't want to stand there and type in a passcode. And I understand that. I really do. I like convenience just like the next person, which is why, number one, that what you said, I love the Touch ID on the newer iPhones. It's so much quicker and so much more secure. Because, by the way, a Touch ID doesn't mean that you don't have a passcode, right?
Right.
It's almost, you have to have a passcode before you can do a Touch ID. But to me, that's more convenient. In other words, I think that we've evolved to the point where a passcode, not very convenient, but it makes it more secure. But now, as long as you know that there are the touch ID or the biometric security, if you really want to get CSI on it, you know, we have the biometric security on there, which makes it a little more convenient. But you, to me, that is the absolute minimum that protection you should have on your mobile devices today. Even if you don't carry anything else from your clients, if you get email on your mobile device, you must have a passcode on there. That is a reasonable precaution from a reasonable standpoint that you can protect the information on there. It's not perfect. Can somebody break in? Of course they can. Just like somebody can break into your office and take your entire file cabinet. But at least then you have a reasonable step from a minimum standpoint of having your information protected on the mobile device.
And I would say just that third part to the ethical responsibility of using these mobile devices is that you have to back them up.
Absolutely.
You know, we've all been at the Genius Bar in the Apple Store and somebody comes in and says, I've got all my work documents on this phone and it's not backed up. What do I do?
Right.
Yeah. You're done. And now you really have an ethical dilemma.
That's my second point that I always get to, Neil, is the backup. Once you have the passcode, number two, backup. And now today, of course, I would say from both components, most of us know that there is a cloud-based backup. When you work on the iPad and the iPhone, there is an iCloud backup that if you have a free iCloud account, you get 5 gigabytes for free, which is not a whole lot, but it's usually enough for most people on their phone to back it up. And so if you turn that on in the iCloud settings on the iPhone, if you have the phone, for example, plugged in overnight, so it's charging and it's connected to Wi-Fi overnight, it will do a backup to the iCloud so that it can be restored. Now, that's great. And for the most part, I rely on that, Neil. But I also tell people, at least on the iPhone and the iPad, you can also do a local backup on your computer, Windows or Mac, using the iTunes software. You know, we don't plug our iPhones or iPads into our computers anymore, right? Because we can just download everything. We used to have to do that when we had the iPod way back in the day or the first iPhones. But now we rarely ever plug it into a computer. But about once a week, I would say, if I'm sitting at my desk at my Mac, I will plug in my iPhone and the iTunes software pops up and you can do a local backup there on your computer. So you can't ever have enough backups. So at least then I'm covered both from the cloud standpoint. If I needed to restore my phone or go, you know, if I lost it or it got stolen, I could close out the old phone and then I could restore with the backup that I have either from the iCloud or from the local backup. So backup's absolutely important.
Yeah. And then I'm going to say maybe the third or last point here is, don't we need that automated way of locking the phone remotely if you lose it?
Yep, that's my number three, Neil. You're right on. I mean, with the iPhone.
I haven't seen your presentation.
But I know. This is
great. But it kind of falls right in line here, so I love it.
It's great. Well, with the, you know, Apple, when they announced the iPhone and the iPad, they developed a service. It's basically a service as part of their iCloud service that everybody, a lot of people know about today. It's called Find My iPhone. So it kind of, you know, bends over to Find My iPad as well. But the idea is, just about any smartphone or smart mobile device you have today, not only does it have a Wi-Fi radio and a Bluetooth radio, but it usually will also have a GPS radio, which is great because we can find, you know, our way on Apple Maps or Google Maps, or it can find where the phone is. But that also means that it is tracking it through the iCloud service. Some people get a little scared about this. You know, it sounds a little Big Brother-ish, and I understand that. You could turn that off if you wanted to so that you don't have to be tracked. But here's the genius of it is where you're going to here. If I accidentally lose my iPhone, leave it somewhere, or if somebody comes up and grabs it and runs away with it, or somebody takes my iPad or I leave it somewhere and I don't realize it until later on, I can go to any computer connected to the internet, go to iCloud.com, log in with my iCloud account, and I can literally track it on a map exactly where the device is. I'm sure everybody listening has probably read a story. I mean, the internet is full of great, good stories about people finding their iPhone. You know, I'm not going to
track it down.
Yeah, I'm not saying you need to be the vigilante here and, you know, go track it down with a baseball bat or something, but you at least can find where it is so you can notify local officials, for example, law enforcement, so they can go and find it if that's the case. But frankly, many times it's just, I know a friend that left their iPad on a plane. She was here in Ohio, and it was up in the luggage rack. She didn't realize it until she got to the office, and basically she tracked the iPad back and forth across from Phoenix back to Ohio a couple of times, and she kept sending messages to the device saying, "I'm lost. Please call this number." And ultimately, one of the flight attendants finally heard it beeping up in the luggage rack and was able to return it.
Yeah.
But you know, it's so great that we have this capability today. And Android and other devices have some similar services. Nothing is quite as integrated as it is with the iPhone and the iPad, simply because you know Apple owns the iCloud service and the devices as well. But in my mind, that's the third component of truly having an ethical approach to managing your mobile devices. And by the way, big firms have a lot of this built in. We have what we call mobile device management systems, you know, big systems, because of course they have, you know, a small army of IT professionals that are dedicated to tracking mobile devices because they have so many that they have to juggle. But here, now, even, you know, the solo has access to some of that same technology by simply using the iCloud service. And it's all secure. You know, you put the passcode in, you can have it ping, and then what we call the nuclear option, you know, if you know that you're not going to get it back because you've tracked your iPhone to Timbuktu or something, then you can send an erase function so that all of that confidential information, including the email, is all completely erased from the iPhone. And that's a good tool to have as well.
Brad, I want to move on a little bit here because you and I will probably talk all afternoon about this subject. Let's do this. How about you share with our audience, I don't know, your top five mobile apps these days?
Oh, okay. I love those. Okay. I'll do it fairly quickly. For lawyers, a lot of times I say one of the first things you need is some kind of a PDF or file manager. And my two favorite are GoodReader, which I think is about $4.99. And the next one is PDF Expert, which I think is $9.99. In my mind, these apps are like digital manila folders. When I'm getting ready to leave the office, I will download the documents I need to read on a plane or if I need to take with me to court. I used to print everything out and then put it into a manila folder in my briefcase. But now I just make sure that there's copies on my iPad. And I use those two apps to manage. And it's not just PDF files. They can read Word documents and images and little videos. So GoodReader or PDF Expert, I like.
Yeah, GoodReader's been around for a while.
Long time.
Yeah. One of the first.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I have a short review, if you'll allow me just real quick. I have a new website, appsinlaw.com, and I did my first review was on GoodReader, and I'm going to be doing PDF Expert soon as well.
Excellent.
But the next app that I think today, and this is almost heretical to even bring up Microsoft's name in my world because I deal with Macs and iOS devices. But Microsoft has done a fantastic job with their Microsoft Office apps for iOS. They actually, it took a long time for them to come in. Actually, in March of 2014 is when they finally released an official Microsoft Word, Excel, and PowerPoint app for the iPad and for the iPhone, but those are fantastic apps. And for me, and for any lawyer that deals with Word documents, it's just great to be able to have that access to those apps on your iPad and your iPhone. And you might want to consider subscribing. A lot of solos, I say today, subscribe to Office 365. You know, instead of buying Microsoft Office, a lot of us can subscribe to Office 365, which is about, it's at least $100 a year, but you might want to go up to about, let's say, I think $150 a year gets you some extra access to the Exchange server. The apps for the iPhone and the iPad are free, Neil, so you can just download it. And as long as you have access to your Office 365 subscription, you can just use those apps there on your iPad, and those are great.
And it keeps the files in the Microsoft cloud?
It does. In fact, OneDrive is Microsoft's cloud storage service. I actually use Dropbox quite a bit. The Microsoft Office apps will connect with Dropbox as well as Box.com. Right. And then like SharePoint services as well.
So you can use any of those cloud storage services to store your Microsoft formatted documents in.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, my little soapbox here, I'll jump on just with one foot and balance here while I rant a little bit. I was a huge Microsoft Office user back in the day, with standalone on the Mac. Then they decided they didn't want to support it anymore. And so I went all the way over to the other side to, you know, Apple Works and iLife and all of that. And I'm hesitant to go back. That's me.
Yeah.
You know, I give up a little bit using Pages as a word processor. I'll give up a little bit. Little bit using numbers as a spreadsheet tool.
Yeah.
I'm ahead of the game, I think, using Keynote over PowerPoint, but that's just me.
I agree.
But I'm just a little hesitant to go back to Microsoft Office, Brett.
You know? I hear you. I do, Neil. And for somebody like you, I know you a little bit, so I think you as a person can probably work in that world that, like, you know, you create a Pages document, you don't have a problem converting it to Word. You need to send it to somebody. But I find a lot of folks today, you know, the vast majority of people are still fully into the Microsoft Office environment. So for folks like you and some of our other friends that we know from the Mac lawyer community, you know, you can work in that and sort of, you know, put one foot in both worlds and be fine. But I find for a lot of folks, they just need to know what's going to work. And in my mind, I always say, hey, stay in the Microsoft Office. They're doing a great job with the Office apps now and the 365.
Well, I will tell you that the thing that may drive me back is if Pages doesn't hurry up and get a outlining function,
a
table of contents function.
They haven't gotten an update in a long time on that.
You know, anyway. All right, so let's go. We had PDF readers. We had Microsoft Office. What else do you think the lawyers should have on their mobile devices?
Note-taking. I always break note-taking up in either typing and handwriting notes. I mean, for me, the iPad has replaced my yellow legal pad. Yep. I used to like handwrite notes on a yellow legal pad, come back to the office, and then I would use my ScanSnap scanner to scan all of my handwritten notes into PDF files so that I could save it with other files that I had from a specific client, for example.
And throw the paper away.
Exactly. And now I can cut out that middle step. The only I use a couple of my favorite ones, of course, is NoteShelf, just all one word, NoteShelf, which I've been using for a long time. Notability is probably the one that I recommend to most folks. You can either type or handwrite your notes. Of course, if you have an iPad Pro, both of those apps now support the Apple Pencil, which is a phenomenal experience if you haven't done that. We used to have to use, you know, really stubby, big, fat little styluses. Mm-hmm. But now with the Apple Pencil, if you go to an Apple store, you can try it yourself. It's just amazing how similar it is to writing with a ballpoint pen on a piece of paper. But both of those apps and others, like GoodNotes is another one, several others, but Notability is usually the one that I recommend folks start with. You can write your notes. I even, at conferences, I'll take pictures and import them into my note, for example, and write notes around. You can then export those notes as PDF files. And then you can upload it directly to Dropbox, for example, or email it to your assistant or whatever the case may be. You can do a whole lot of that there from the either from the iPhone or from the iPad.
I used Notability quite a lot in depositions.
Yeah.
Taking notes because it also will record the deposition. Yeah.
Isn't that great?
Which is remarkable because we make a decision after the fact of whether or not we want to order the deposition recording and do the transcript. Well, I have the audio recording in my notes, and in many cases, that's completely sufficient for my needs as a litigator.
Right. But and one step more, not only does it record the audio at the same time you're taking notes, but it synchronizes the two together. Right? I don't know how often you use
it. Absolutely.
You can tap into the middle of, like, let's say, page 2 of your written notes, and it'll start playing the audio from that point when it was recording at the time.
Which is spectacular.
It is. It is. It's great. It's good stuff.
And, we're like three. That's three. You got a couple more?
Okay, two. Absolutely. You know, we've already talked about the importance of security. One of my favorite apps, if you're a Mac user, but if you're an iPhone or an iPad user, you need to have a password management system of some kind. My favorite, if you're on the Mac side or the Apple side, is 1Password. It's the numeral 1 and then the word password. Phenomenal system there. And they do now have a Windows component on there as well. Now, there's others I know like LastPass and KeePass and There's a couple of others out there that I know that a lot of people will go for. But to me, it's important to invest in a good password management system. This will sync between your different devices and your Mac and your computers as well. And it's a one place where not only can you just keep like your passwords for your online banking and your Amazon account, but 1Password will also let you take pictures of your social security card or your driver's license or your credit cards so that you have a secure location where you have all of the important stuff that you need. You know, we used to go throw it into a safety deposit box at a bank, and you can still use that, certainly. But 1Password for me has almost replaced a lot of that because that's where I keep everything I know is important, not just to me and my own family, but my folks and my parents and my other, you know, extended family. It's like that's a one location where I know that I have one secure password that I have dedicated to memory. I hate to memorize tons and tons of passwords, but then 1Password will also ensure that I have very secure passwords for any logins or software licenses that I have. So yeah. I like 1Password.
Yeah. And I'm as a estate planning attorney, you know, I tell my clients a lot of times that this is really an important factor now in all of our lives.
Yes.
When you pass, who's going to have access to all your accounts? Who's going to have access to your Facebook account?
Right.
Close your Facebook account down. And who's going to have access to your banking accounts and all those things that we do electronically now?
Yeah.
And so 1Password is a great resource for that because you can entrust your spouse or your partner or just somebody that you feel is holds that trust, is worthy of that trust, with your master password to use in the event of your passing.
Yeah, that's a great point, Neil. I do that for my father. Absolutely, exactly what you're talking about. It's where we have some of the documents, I've either scanned them in or taken pictures, but just like you said, I have it for like, you know, their bank account in case something, you know, God forbid would happen. But I have all that right there. It really is convenient.
And it's encrypted and secure, so.
Absolutely.
All right, last one.
Oh, here's one of my favorite. An iPhone and an iPad, the cameras have become much, much better over each successive iteration of the hardware. So if you have a camera on the device, and let's say you're out at a court and somebody hands you a document, or you're at a client site and, you know, the client wants to give you a copy of the document. So they say, you know, sit here, I'm going to run down the hall and I'm going to make a copy and I'll come back. Why bother with all that? You've got a great camera on these devices and you have apps. One of my favorite is Scanner Pro. There's another one called ScanBot that literally turns my iPhone or my iPad into a portable scanner. I love this. In fact, I just reviewed Scanner Pro on my my website, appsandlaw.com as well. You can go there and kind of see how it looks in action there. But you can literally, I mean, I have my iPhone with me already. You have it surgically attached to your hand.
Yep.
If you need a copy of a document, you just set it on the desk and you basically just hold the iPhone. You've got to make sure you have a good camera. So the most recent iPads and the iPhones are going to be better at this. As I said in my review, you know, a good camera means you're going to have a better picture, means it's a better scan. Because frankly, that's all that a scan is. You're just basically taking a picture of the document. You know, the iPhone doesn't know if you're taking a picture of a polar bear or a document. But if you say this is a document, and one of the big things that both of these apps do, Scanner Pro and ScanBot, they now have what we call optical character recognition built in, or OCR. So that you say, hey, this is a document. There's text on there. I can read it with my human eyeballs, the text on that document. But iPhone, I want you to try to recognize each character on there as well so that I can use the text out of there. Now, the OCR isn't going to be as good as maybe something that you find in Adobe Acrobat or in the ScanSnap software, but it's many times good enough. You just need a copy of the document, and that's a good way to do it. So ScanBot and Scanner Pro, to me, are two of the best on this. And I just love the fact that you have this as a tool that you can use since you're out in the world and you need to make a copy of it or you know, basically take a quick scan of a document that somebody hands you.
Well, I'm happy to say of all the apps that you've recommended here, I have them all on my phone.
I figured you would.
With the exception of Microsoft Office. So Brett, let's wrap this up a little bit here and talk about your new venture. You've mentioned it a couple times, Apps in Law.
Yes, sir.
Tell our audience a little bit about that. What started it and where you're heading with it?
Oh, great. Thanks. Okay, so just quickly, since I talk to a lot of lawyers about using Macs in their practice, and of course, that's now gone out to the iPhone and the iPad, anytime I go, people have the same question that you and I just gone through and had so much fun, Neil. What is the best app for doing this? Or, you know, what's the best app for using at a trial presentation? Or what's the best app for taking notes? And so I started this site with very short video reviews. It's called appsinlaw.com. Just some YouTube videos. I'm trying not to make them any longer than about 3 minutes. But it just gives you a flavor and an idea of what the app can do. What are some of the good points and a couple of the bad points of the app so that you can go in and understand what it can do and what it can do for you. For example, the Scanner Pro, I went through and just showed you how it works and what are some of the good features that that they have about it. I mean, to me, this is such an exciting time with this app ecosystem, is sort of that I call it, you know. And we didn't have this when the first iPhone came about. We only just had the stock apps that came with the iPhone, which is just mind-blowing today. But, you know, they opened it up within a couple of years. And so now, you know, we just saw the WWDC conference that Apple hosts, and they're opening it up even more. Like, it's just, it's amazing to me that we have dedicated apps that's different than what we used to have with software applications on the computer. And it's a great, exciting time. It's just neat that we have a scanning app, for example, on an iPad or an iPhone that can do, you know, so much more than we used to have these bulky network scanners. It's things like that that get me excited. And anyway, that's what I wanted to come across with on my website, Apps in Law.
Well, I think it's a great website. I've gone through all of the episodes on the site, all the entries on the site, and love every minute of it. So I hope you keep it up. And I'm going to tell you that we get a lot of feedback from listeners who are not attorneys, ironically, who are subscribed to The Law Entrepreneur, because there's a lot of things you can take away from the discussion that aren't necessarily focused solely on the law. And I think this is a great example of that. The ethical use of mobile devices has a lot for any business owner or any individual who uses these devices to think about. And your list of apps that make these devices more productive in our lives and more useful in our lives is, you know, something we can sit around and talk about all day.
Right.
You know, well, what's your favorite voice recognition app? And you can play that game.
Absolutely.
You know, all night long. So I'd love to have you come back, Brett, and we can yak again on, you know, whatever our heart desires about this.
You know, just one more quick thing quickly on the security, because it came to me. You know, we were talking about the passcodes. I just want to throw this out because I see this happening a lot of times, either with lawyers that have kids that like to use their iPads sometimes or folks. I just want to throw this out, Neil, that some of these apps we've talked about, like Goodreader, for example, and I know that the Dropbox app does this and some of the others, because they know that your iPad may be open already and somebody may be using it, some of these apps do allow you to put an additional passcode for those, specifically just for those apps. In other words, your iPad may be open and people may be, you know, somebody else may be using it or you may have it open. But if you wanted to open Goodreader, for example, it would require you to put in like an additional passcode, maybe a different passcode. And I like to throw that out. It's something that I don't hear a lot of people talking about, but, you know, just to kind of wrap this up from an ethical standpoint, it's good to understand that individual apps may have some additional security features in place. And I think that's a good one, like the Dropbox app, for example, and some of the other ones, if you go into it, they require you to put yet another passcode in there. And I know that that's something else you have to remember, but I always tell people, you know, it can be the PIN that you use for your ATM. Hopefully that's a secure PIN, right? So something like that, something that is easy for you to remember, it's yet another level of security that you can put in place to ensure that you're doing as much as you can to make sure that it is protected.
Brett, when are you going to be back on the East Coast?
I hope so. Actually, we're going to be in about a month or two and out in Philadelphia doing an all-day iPad session for a lot of the lawyers there. We've been doing that for a few years, which is always exciting. But yeah, my website is BernieConsultants.com, and I usually put up there any kind of announcements that I have for upcoming events or presentations.
And is that the best way our listeners can get a hold of you if they want to reach out and touch, so to speak?
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Yeah. BernieConsultants.com. And then I have links to all my other places there too.
Great. Well, Brett, thanks ever so much for being a part of the show today. And I appreciate you taking the time to be on The Law Entrepreneur. And I look forward to catching up with you real soon now.
Thanks again, Neil. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Well, there you have it, fellow law entrepreneurs. Thank you for listening and being a part of today's program. The utmost compliment you could pay me is to go over to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and leave a strong 5-star review if you think the podcast and what we're trying to do here is worthwhile. Feel free to share the link to the podcast with your friends, family, and coworkers. I would be very appreciative if you did. So until next time, thanks again for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.